I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 171 of the Intercooler Podcast with me, Dan Prosser. No Andrew Frankel this week, but I've got a special guest in his place. A very special guest actually. Steve Nichols, one of the great Formula One designers, won multiple world championships with McLaren, designed some sensational cars. And he's also recently, just last week in fact, revealed his first road car. So we start by talking about his road car, the Nichols N1A, and then we get into Formula One, how he got started in F1, his time at McLaren, including that extraordinary Senna-Prost era, and then his experiences at Ferrari, and after that, and some of the drivers, some of the fantastic, the wonderful drivers, the world champions that he worked with. So hopefully it's a good listen. There's some background noise. The sound quality might not be the best, but you can hear Steve very clearly. So I think you'll enjoy listening. But before we get started, we do have some news to share with you. News of our first ever live podcast recording, really our first social event. It's at Henry's Car Barn later on in August. And it's, for now, it's a subscriber only thing. We've made tickets available only to subscribers to the Intercooler. And actually ticket sales have gone really well. I should say we've got a guest, for that live podcast recording, Henry Catchpole, who's one of our writers, of course. And we're going to be recording a podcast in front of an audience, and it's a bit of a social evening. We're going to be putting on food and drink. There'll be some other TI writers there. At this wonderful venue, Henry's Car Barn, near Gaydon. So it promises to be a really special evening. Now, as I record this, most of the tickets have gone. We only released them for sale on Saturday morning, and on Monday morning, there are only a few left. So by the time this episode goes out, they might all be gone. If that is the case, worry not, because we have a second event already in the works. And we will be sharing news of that very soon. So if you want to come along to one of our live podcast recordings, just stay tuned to our channels, the app, the website, our social media, and we'll have news of our next live event very soon. But for now, enjoy this episode of the podcast with F1 designer Steve Nichols. We saw your first road car last week, Steve, the Nichols N1A, N for Nichols. We'll come on to the specification in a moment, but it's clearly and proudly inspired by the McLaren M1A. That's the racing car that really put McLaren on the map in the 60s. Has that always been a favourite car of yours, the M1A?
Well, I have quite liked it, and yeah, you know, I've been a fan of McLaren for a long time, really. And you know, you had these legendary figures back then. Bruce McLaren founded a company, designed a car, raced the car. You know, the sort of thing you just wouldn't get these days, similar to Jack Brabham. So that was always something quite special. And then, of course, I started in Formula One with McLaren, and so yeah, I've been quite a fan. And the M1A being effectively Bruce's first car, I liked the look of it. And my friend John Minan and I that started this project, with the thought was to do a car that took its aesthetic considerations from that original M1A, and it was his idea to call it the N1A and name it after me. I was a little reluctant in the beginning, tend to like to be more under the radar, so to speak, but he convinced me to let it be called the Nichols, and the N1A resonated a little bit with the M1A, and so that's kind of the way it all started. And of course you can see the aesthetic connections, some styling considerations connected to the M1A. It's a little wider, you know, the wheels and tires are a bit bigger, so it's wider and it's a bit longer than the original, but you can still see the styling cues. So the car generally is a combination of historical elements, mostly aesthetic, and then the more modern elements.
So let me run through the specification, and to everyone listening, just have a think about how many new cars in production today have a specification quite like this one. So the N1A is open top, of course, weighs about 900 kilograms, has up to 650 brake horsepower in a 900 kilo car from a 7-litre Chevy small block V8 with a dry sump, so the engine's nice and low. Carbon fibre and aluminium construction. ABS and power steering are optional. It does have traction control. It appears to be a raw, stripped-back driver's car, the likes of which we just don't see on sale today. I think it's extraordinary. Huge credit to you and everyone you're working with for producing something quite like this. Now, is it a track car, or is it a road car? Is it a weekend car? How do you sort of imagine people will use it?
Well, probably all of the above. It's officially called a track day car, I suppose. It will be road legal, and obviously you can take it on the track, and that's probably where it will be most at home. But it is road legal, and you know, sunny afternoon, you want to drive to the pub and have lunch and show up or whatever, you know, then obviously it's good for that. From the work that we've done so far, it has very good road manners. It doesn't do nasty things under hard acceleration, so it's quite, and that engine is quite tractable, and it's not sort of peaky like a race car. So it's good for both, and people can do what they like with it. You know, drive it on the road, drive it on the track. Probably not best to go to the supermarket for the weekly grocery shop, but you know, it's fun to drive, and a bit old school, manual gearbox, normally aspirated, has that rather lovely American V8 sound, you know, so it's got a lot going for it visually and from the point of view of the sound it makes. So yeah, it's turned out very well, I think, and the specification that you mentioned is quite lightweight, quite a lot of power. Hence, I think it's a good idea to have traction control to give people a bit more confidence and a bit more of a safety factor. And as your driving skills improve, perhaps you want to tone down the traction control. But it is a little bit of a worry of mine that it's got quite a lot of power and quite lightweight, so people have to be respectful of that. Our intention is to include some driver training with some professional drivers to make sure that the customers can adequately handle the car and would improve their experience by having some instruction from professional drivers. Because we want them to enjoy the ride and not just be frightened by the power, if you see it.
So what stage is the project at now? We've seen what looks like the finished thing, but there's still some more testing to do.
Yes, there's a few things to finish off, a little bit of plumbing and some electrical, some things to do with wiring loom, and startup should be later this week or early next week. And then we'd start a testing process. First thing would be just to do, we'd do some shakedown tests, just gently drive it around, so to speak, to make sure the systems all work. And bit similar to, you know, the Formula One cars, they always do an installation lab first and check things over. And then we carry on to just do some road miles. You put some road miles on it to start to verify reliability and any issues that might come up as we put more miles on the car. And then after that, I'd like a more intensive testing program with some professional drivers to do some development work with the car, some tuning, you know, where are we regarding springs and dampers and things like that. So some suspension tuning. And my own driving experience has been pretty much entirely with small formula cars, so I'd like some guys to drive the car that are more experienced with heavier, high-powered sports cars, to tune the handling and make sure everything's exactly right. And the tuning can be altered a bit if the customer wants it a little more track-oriented, we can do that, or if they feel like maybe they'll be doing more road driving with it, then maybe soften it off a bit so we can tune it to whatever the individual customers prefer.
Now, you haven't announced the price yet. It'll only ever be built in very limited numbers. But you have told me before we started recording that you don't want it to be multi-millions. You want it to be a slightly more affordable kind of car than that, don't you?
Well, that's right. And my partner, John, he's more involved with the marketing side and pricing and that sort of thing. We were going to do a limited production run first of 15 cars. And these will be a higher spec and a higher price. And they're each named after the 15 races that we won with the MP44 in 1988. I think the price of those, John has told me, is going to be in the neighbourhood of £375,000, and then there may be a few options. And then we'd have the standard car, the more volume production, although it's never going to be huge volume. It depends on the uptake and how many people want one, but yeah, you might get to the point where you're making one a month or something if the demand is there. And those cars would be substantially cheaper. Still quite expensive, a couple £100,000 maybe. It's so hard to make anything really inexpensive in small volume. I'd like it to be a lot less expensive so that more people could afford it, you know, enthusiasts could afford it. But it's just so hard to make anything really inexpensive in small volumes. But so, you know, not exactly inexpensive, but it's not the multi-million pound sort of cars that you see from various manufacturers currently.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're talking a lot of money, but these are sensible numbers compared to some that we hear about these days, 2, 3, 4 million, you know. It's all gone
at the top end
of the market, really. So, yeah.
I think it'd be really nice to be able to make, I don't know, a 50 or a 60 or a 70,000 pound car that was high performance and much more affordable. But that's so hard to do unless you're really a major manufacturer and making things in much greater volume. So it's kind of an impossible dream for him to make a car that inexpensive. Be just because of the cost of doing things in small volume.
I think it's fantastic. You know, the big OEMs, the Ferraris, the Lamborghinis, even the Porsches, all the others, they seem to have no interest in building these very pure driver's cars. And it does take the likes of Nichols and the likes of even resto modding companies to produce these kind of cars that diehard enthusiasts like us look at and just think, wow, that's fantastic. So brilliant. Yeah. I'm so glad there are people out there building these things.
Well, I hope that most of these cars end up in the hands of enthusiasts who use them and drive them, and I don't want them to end up in somebody's crash, you know, and they're just, under a car cover at some car storage place. You know, it'd be nice that they're actually out there driving them, using them, enjoying them.
Well, we will keep a close eye on the N1A. We look forward to hearing more about it, seeing it testing, learning a few more details, and maybe having a go at some point. Well done for getting it this far. I can only imagine how challenging it is to
It has been very challenging. It's taken much longer time than I wanted it to. We've always been operating with quite limited resources, which means it takes longer, and the whole virus thing didn't help because suppliers are all delayed, you know, with their own COVID problems, and so that's been a struggle too. But we have managed to struggle through on fairly limited funds and get it to this point, and now we've taken a couple of deposits, so it's starting to roll, I suppose. We didn't really want to start taking deposits until it was complete and people could see exactly what they were going to get. But we have had a couple of people that were sort of insistent on putting down a deposit to sort of ensure their position in the build schedule. So hopefully now that it's officially launched, we've had quite a lot of contacts from quite a lot of people, and hopefully many of those are serious, and we can get a little bit of a production run going.
So it is an open top, very powerful sports car, road legal. It looks like a sort of 1960s Can-Am car, and that is what the McLaren M1A eventually evolved into. But of course, it's informed by your 20 plus years as an engineer and designer in Formula One, right? So let's get on to that, shall we?
Okay.
You have that rarest of things in the Formula One paddock. It's an American accent. It's unusual, isn't it? Even now to hear an American accent in Formula One. You grew up in Salt Lake City, Utah. Were you aware of F1 growing up?
Well, I was aware from quite an early age. 1961, I started racing go-karts when I was just a kid, and of course they're done on little miniature road courses, so I was always more interested in road racing compared to American drag racing or stock cars. So that led me inevitably to be interested in Formula One. And my first real interest in Formula One came in 1962. There was an article in 1962 in Road and Track magazine. The cover article was headlined Chapman's Tubeless Wonder, and it was kind of the launch of the Lotus 25.
The monocoque car.
Monocoque car, and beautiful, slender, simple, elegant, just everything that I thought design should be. And so I was kind of blown away by that car and decided then as a child that I wanted to be a Formula One designer. But it's a long way from the Rocky Mountains to Europe and Formula One, so it's been quite a journey to get there, and inevitably I suppose it's unique, the American accent in Formula One. And I suppose my accent now is, you might call it mid-Atlantic, so part English, part American. If I go to America, they think I sound English, but in England they think I sound American, so, you know, I'm a foreigner everywhere, I guess.
So you knew from a very early age, actually, what you wanted to do. And it was in 1980 that you flew across the Atlantic to start working at McLaren. Although it wasn't quite McLaren then, was it? It was just the tail end of Project 4, Ron Dennis's organisation, before it merged with Team McLaren.
That's right, yeah. That was quite an ambitious thing for Ron to take on board. Visionary of a of a man like Ron to take that on, who'd been quite successful as a team owner operator in Formula 2 and Formula 3. And he hired John Barnard, who equally was very visionary in wanting to design a Formula 1 car with a carbon monocoque. So incredible to do that. When you think of Ron Dennis taking that sort of risk, nobody else in Formula 1 wanted to take on building a complete Formula 1 monocoque in carbon fibre. The problem for John and Ron was they couldn't find anybody, any of the carbon fibre sort of people, aerospace or whatever, in England that would take that on. They thought it was all too ambitious. So that gives you the level of ambition and risk that both Ron and John were taking. I had worked, my sort of first professional job in motor racing was designing dampers for Gabriel, and I designed the dampers for various teams there, including Vels Parnelli-Jones, where John Barnard was working, and for the Chaparral, Jim Hall's Chaparral team. And John obviously did the design on that beautiful Chaparral car as well. So John, I knew, had gone back to England after the Chaparral days to do this Formula One car for Ron Dennis and Project 4. And I contacted him looking for a job in Formula One, and hence this little introduction in July of 1980, where I took a leave of absence from my day job and came over and worked on the original MP44 with John. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. When I first contacted John for a job, he was telling me that they couldn't find anybody to make it. He told me that he wanted to do an innovative new Formula One car. It was very important in those days to have a slender monocoque so you could have wide aerodynamic side pods to generate more downforce, but he didn't like the floppy sort of aluminium monocoques that resulted from being quite narrow. So he said he wanted to use some innovative new materials, and I was familiar with carbon fiber from my days in aerospace, building rocket motors for the Trident missile, intercontinental ballistic missiles for the Trident submarines. So I said to him, well, that'll be carbon fiber then. And he said, well, yes, since you've guessed, we want to do a carbon fiber monocoque. I can't find anybody to make it. And I said, I know my ex-colleagues from Hercules, where it was my first job out of university. They want to expand the use of carbon fibers into areas outside of aerospace. And I think they'd be interested in this because it's a worldwide exposure in areas outside of aerospace. And so I contacted them, and indeed they were interested. And eventually John and Ron flew over to Salt Lake City and did a deal with them to help in the manufacture of those first monocoques. And of course, that was the beginning of the carbon revolution, you might say.
Made the introduction that enabled the first carbon fiber Formula One car to be made.
Yeah, that's right. I hasten
without to Steve Nichols, was, who knows?
Well, that's a bit... Yeah, that might be a bit extreme, but... you know, John had the vision to take the risk on that project, and Ron had the vision to finance it. And I was able to, all I did was make the introduction to Hercules. But you can see what happened from that nucleus or that seed.
Yeah, no turning back.
You know, all the WEC cars, all the Formula One car, everything's made out of carbon these days, and carbon fiber. Monaco road cars, you know, even our little N1A has got some carbon fiber panels in it. It's quite a sophisticated chassis. It's a bonded aluminium chassis developed by the same people that developed the bonded aluminium chassis for the Lotus road cars. It's got these highly developed Chevy engines, the LS series of engines. They've been in development for 70 years, and it's got that little connection to the big banger Can-Am cars, but they're really very sophisticated engines now. You know, they're light and they're powerful and relatively inexpensive, so you know it's quite a good power plant. And then it's got a highly developed Graziano transaxle, like the one used in the Audi R8. So the combination of that chassis and gearbox and the engine, it's all quite sophisticated. And we've brought in people to work on the suspension. I always like to try to get the best people I can in the various areas. So Richard Herdwell, ex-Lotus, has helped us to develop the suspension characteristics. So, you know, altogether, it looks promising. Looks like it's a very good package.
So let's go back to the first few years at McLaren. Do you remember what you were doing in those early days? Of course, design and engineering teams in those days were much, much smaller than they are now. So presumably you were fairly heavily involved in the cars as a whole.
Oh, yeah. It was great, really. You know, when I first came over in July, this is a pretty sophisticated project, carbon fiber monocoque, you know, Formula One car, all of that. And there were three of us. John Barnard was the chief designer, and there was Alan Jenkins, who was already there, and there was me. And it was just the three of us, and we were doing this sophisticated carbon fiber monocoque, you know, leading edge. Nobody had ever done it before. Then when John... when Ron sorted out the finances, he called it, which was the marriage of Project 4 and Team McLaren to form McLaren International, then we inherited from them some more staff. John Baldwin came over, for example, from McLaren to bolster the design team, and we had a couple of draftsmen from McLaren, Mike Locke and Colin Smith, who bolstered the ranks as well, and it grew from there. But you know, even when we were doing championship winning cars in 1984, I don't know, the whole technical team was maybe 9, 10, 11 people. And a few years later in 1988, when we were designing the MP44, the whole technical staff, race engineers, designers, everybody, the whole technical staff was 17 people. And when you consider John had left in tail end of August of 87, and so from 87 to 89, you know, we had to do the MP43 and the MP43B with the new changing over from the TAG turbo engine to the Honda engine, and you know, a test car for that. And then we did the MP44 and we did an MP44B with 10 cylinder normally aspirated engine, and then we did the 5 which was the proper race car with the 10 cylinder Honda engine. And then we began work on the MP46, which was the 12 cylinder car. All that in the period of 3 or 4 years with 17 people, you know.
Wow.
Hence the gray hair.
Let's talk about the MP44, 1988. Famously won 15 of that year's 16 races with Alan Prost and Ayrton Senna. Now, this means that you are one of few people around today who can tell us what everyone at Red Bull is feeling at the moment, right? Bear with me. The RB19... Yeah. This year's Red Bull is a similarly dominant car.
Absolutely.
In fact, it's won all 12 races so far. It might go one better than the 4-4 by winning every race.
Well, it could do. It could do. I was kind of hoping that it might be a bit poetic, so to speak, if Lando could win a race or two McLaren could preserve McLaren's own records, you know. So, at the time... you know, we never thought that it would win all the races, but we kept on winning, and I thought, well, you know, eventually something will happen, and of course that happened at Monza, where we had a minor technical problem with Prost car, as a bad spark plug, as it turned out, and then it was hard for us to win some of those races. You have to think back to what it was like then. It was a transition year where the FIA wanted the normally aspirated cars to win. That was the future. And So they had 3.5 liters, they had unlimited fuel, and 15 kilos lighter. They were supposed to win. So it was hard for us to win. And you take that Monza race, we used to struggle on the fuel. We had 150 liters of fuel. And I know they talk these days about lift and coast. And, you know, we had to do all that too, lift and coast and limit the revs and limit the boost. And the drivers had to take it out of themselves and out of the car. You know, they couldn't afford to just cruise with loads of horsepower. So we were in a situation at Monza where it was a struggle for us and to stay ahead of everybody. And we used to go into fuel debt, as I'd call it. We might be a lap or two down on the fuel because we'd used more boost and more revs to stay ahead. And then towards the end of the race, we had to try to gain that back. And that's the situation we were in. And Senna was in a position where he had to be absolutely on the limit every lap, every corner, taking it out of himself, taking it out of the car, and not using too much fuel. So he arrived at the chicane with Schlesser in the way, and he's got 1/100 of a second to decide what he's going to do, and he knows he's got to go for it, which he did, and which was absolutely the right thing to do, but it just didn't quite work out. But I've always kind of thought since, in a way, for the sport, it's quite good that we missed one race, so that everybody's got that perfect season to shoot for.
It was also the first Italian Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's right.
The old
that's
man. Right. Enzo yeah. Ferrari died. So there's, and Ferrari yeah. won that race. So
yeah, it was all quite nice. I would have still liked to have won that race, but it was all quite nice. I thought it was a great year, too, in that a lot of people have said, oh, well, you know, it was kind of boring, McLaren winning all the races. But on the other hand, I looked at it, I thought it was a bit like the America's Cup, a challenge race, you know, match race one-on-one. You had the two best drivers in the world at the time and probably still among the very, very best in a very good car, if I do say so myself. People will say that maybe the competition wasn't so strong, but the reason competition wasn't so strong is because the car was very, very good. The drivers were very, very good. The whole organization was very, very good. And so you get what you got. There was no restriction on the others to do the same. You know, they had their design teams. They had their marketing people generating the budget and all that. And we just did a better job in every area than they did. And that's exactly the same as you get now with the RB19, a very, very good car with at least one very, very good driver. And it does get to be a little bit boring if Verstappen's winning all the races, and wouldn't it be great to have Leclerc or Norris or Lewis or somebody in there giving him a bit of a hard time, which yeah. is what we had yeah. then. You know, Prost and Senna mm-hmm. going at it, hammer and tong. I thought it was very exciting and certainly pretty stressful for me.
So what do you think, having been in that position yourself, what do you think they'll be feeling at Red Bull? Are they smug, or is there a kind of anxiety that comes with having the dominant car? You're worried that they're after you. They're coming.
They won't. They won't be smug, and they won't be taking it for granted. And they will be being very careful to make sure that the car is absolutely legal at every race, because they won't want to stumble over that possibility. The mechanics will be right on the edge, right on their toes. They'll be making sure that everything is perfect in the preparation, because they will know that they have a very good driver, and they will know that they have a very good car, and they will know that they don't want to be the ones to screw it up. So they'll be trying to be absolutely perfect in their preparation, and they'll be trying to be absolutely perfect in their pit stops. And nobody in that whole organization is going to want to screw it up, so to speak. So even though they're in this dominant position, they're an excellent team, and they'll be trying to do everything absolutely perfect.
How tense was the team in 88? Senna, Prost, not really communicating directly with one another. Clearly a huge amount of respect between them. They're the only two who have a chance of winning the championship because the car is so dominant. Is the environment just charged the whole time, all season
yes.
long?
It was very tense, and I thought it was fantastic. I loved it being tense, and I loved being under pressure. and trying to do everything perfect, and it made it seem important to me. And it was stressful. You know, you've got multi-million pound budget, and you've got legendary drivers and legendary team owners, and you don't want to screw it up. And, you know, always in the back of my mind, I was the race engineer. I was the designer of the car, and I was also Senna's race engineer for his first championship. And always in the back of my mind was, don't screw up Senna's championship. So, yeah, it was very tense, but fantastic. You know, maybe everybody isn't the same, but I didn't want an easy life. I wanted to do something that was difficult, and I wanted it to work out. And so you make every effort to be as perfect as you possibly can be, because you know that both Prost and Senna are also trying to be as perfect as they can possibly be. And in fact, as you know, you told me to describe what it would be like at Red Bull right now, and that's based on my own experience in 1988 with the McLaren. But I remember Rick Goodhand once, one of the mechanics, saying to me, we knew that it was a fantastic car and a fantastic design, and we knew that if anybody was going to screw up, it would be us as the mechanics. And so they were under pressure. They put themselves under pressure to make sure that they did everything they could as perfect as possible. And it was like that throughout the whole organization, which is why it turned out the way it did, because just everybody at every level was trying to be as perfect as possible.
So after the 89 season, Prost left McLaren, went to Ferrari, and he took one very important asset with him, you. Was that an easy move for you, or did you have to really deliberate?
It wasn't an easy move, it was a compliment in a way from Alan. It was at Adelaide, you know, he asked me, he said he was going to Ferrari and he wanted me to come with. And so I had to have discussions then with Ron. We disagreed on a couple of things. We disagreed on the organization. Another interesting little story. You remember Gerard Ducruz, who was the Lotus chief designer at the time, and he was such an ace bloke, really great guy, lovely to talk to in the pit lane and all that. And of course, our car was making his car look a bit secondhand, but he was so good about it. And he said to me, don't let Ron get away with it. Make sure you get the money. but Ron wasn't willing to pay the money, and Ferrari were. So the combination of the difference of opinion on money and the difference on the organization meant I ended up going to Ferrari. It would have been nice, really, to remain at McLaren, and it would have been nice if Ron and I could come to an agreement on the organisation and on the money. Yeah, you always sort of think that, well, money wasn't the most important thing to me, but I was more interested in human resources and financial resources for the team so that you could do what you needed to do and do what you wanted to do. But you realise that it's a pretty volatile environment and your career might not last forever. And so you'd like to make a little money out of it while you can. But really, more important to me was the resources, human and financial, for the team. So, you know, I ended up going to Ferrari, but in a lot of ways, I wish we could have worked things out with Ron for me to stay at McLaren, your first love and all.
So for the 1990 season, off you go to Maranello. You have spoken about this in the past, but you've come from a team. Okay, you didn't agree with the plans for the organisation of the engineering department going forward, but it was a well-run team, wasn't it? That was a slick operation at McLaren.
Yeah,
and you found something else at Maranello.
Chaos,
chaos.
But you know, it's a little bizarre. You know, the driver, they always say the drivers, they always want to drive for Ferrari. And I never really had this strong desire as an engineer to to go to Ferrari, but, you know, it's a big team, had the budget, and a lot of staff and all of that, so it did kind of make sense, but only in the light of not being able to come to terms with Rome. But I always thought of McLaren, it never really hit me, the whole Ferrari myth, but when I did get there, there was a couple of things that did strike me. You know, you walk into the building and there's these photographs on the wall, you know, these sort of antique sepia print things, and all these legendary old drivers, you know, from the 50s, and, you know, you think, wow, it is a little bit of a legend, isn't it? Mm. And there's Enzo's office, sort of like a mausoleum or something. Yes. And, you know, so you are struck by the history. And it had a certain elegance to it as well. The cars were just red. I remember seeing a test once, and, you know, you've got the motorhome and then the big Arctic transporter, and it's just red with a big Cavallino on it, a Ferrari. You know, on the bottom, there's a little grey stripe with all their suppliers and things, but there's not big, you know, it's got Fiat on it, you know, because they own the company, but it not sort of blatant sponsorship that you might see elsewhere. And even at the racetrack, the engineering staff and the management staff, we had these navy blue dress trousers and a white shirt with a Cavallino emblem, and that's it. You know, they just had a certain elegance to it, you know, which I quite liked. And that engine, you know, is there anything like a V12 Ferrari screaming at 19,000 RPM? You know, it's just otherworldly. And you could wander out into the machine shop, and they're machining blocks and heads and crankshafts, and you know, it's just phenomenal, really. You know, they do the whole car. It was fantastic, but there's the chaos, and I used to say it's like the dream and the nightmare all happening at the same time. You know, it's just so hard to try to get the chaos under control. And the Italian people, they're so lovely, and they deserve to have their hero team Ferrari be successful, but it seems so hard for them to keep the chaos under control. And when they've been the most successful is when they had a lot of foreign involvement. Chantal, Ross Braun, Schumacher, Nigel Stepney, you know, et cetera, and I don't know, it's just, they're so lovely and they're so artistic and they're so creative. But when it gets right down to hardcore technical, what it takes to win Formula One races and Formula One championships, I don't know, they just come unglued, it seems like. Which is what you see now. It's just a shame that Ferrari seem to be imploding, and then they can't be giving Red Bull a hard time. And, you know, for the fans, for the sport generally, it would be so fantastic to see Ferrari up there. It would be fantastic to see the Mercedes up there. They seem to be imploding a little bit, and they're losing a lot of staff to other teams. And, you know, and Cowell's name developed that engine and disappears off. And I don't know, maybe they suffer from a loss of their human resources, but it's just a shame that somebody can't give them a hard time. You know, Aston Martin made a big step this year, and now it sort of seems to be dissolving a bit. I was hoping that them, with their advantage because of their lowly position last year, and that they get more aero resources, I was hoping that maybe as the year progressed that Red Bull's limited resources would hamper them, and Aston Martin's better position regards aero resources would start to bite at Red Bull a bit. But it seems like Adrian's done such a good job that they can get along on 10% less resources. You know, it shows the genius of the man. I suppose
It hasn't panned out the way many of us hoped, has it really?
It would have been nice to see three or four teams up there.
Yeah, and so
and even inside Red Bull, unfortunately, I'm sure he's a nice guy and he's a very good driver, but he just can't Perez can't seem to give
no.
Verstappen the sort of workout that we'd like to see. Whereas in the 88 season, Prost and Senna were really hard at it. And as you alluded to earlier, it was stressful for everybody. And I'm sure it was very stressful for Prost and Senna. But they were very good at handling that pressure as they needed to be. And the team functioned normally, which people don't necessarily quite understand. It was very hard for Prost and Senna, but the team functioned normally, and the drivers actually worked well together, but without a personal interface. All the data was shared and set up and all of that stuff, but they just didn't talk to each other. You know, if Prost had a question, he'd ask his race engineer, and his race engineer would ask me, and I'd tell him, and then he'd tell Prost, you know, but they didn't talk directly. It's a bit like when you go through a divorce and you can't talk to your wife, you got to talk to the lawyers, and it all goes to the lawyers. Yeah. Yes. It was a bit like that, but the team never split. You know, you remember, I can't remember, Rossi and Lorenzo in MotoGP, and they had a curtain down the middle of the garage. That just never happened. It never split. It never split right at the race engineer level. You know, me and Neil Oatley, we never split. We worked for McLaren, not for the drivers. And therefore, the whole thing just never came unzipped. And Ron was very stressful for him, I'm sure, keeping a lid on the battle between the two of them. But we used to just kind of laugh about it. You know, the drivers not talking to each other, but the rest of the team was a team. And it just worked normally. You know, the big problem there wasn't the rift between Prost and Senna. The big problem there was doing everything perfect so that we could win the races and win the world championship.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I just want to come back to Ferrari because I'm so intrigued by the uniquely Ferrari condition. It is the most successful team in Formula One, but it's been there the longest, almost since day one. And actually, as a proportion of the races it's competed in, the championships it's competed in, it's won less than other teams, and you have to wonder why. It's got fantastic resources. It's able to attract the best drivers. Can you pinpoint the one malaise? Is it from afar, from where I'm sitting, it looks like it might be short-termism as a result of unbearable pressure.
It's all that. The short-termism is a problem. The media pressure is a problem. It's kind of interesting in a way too that the whole Fiat thing is a little bit of a problem. I used to get the impression that the real game going on at Ferrari was big corporation politics, and the Formula One team was the playing board that game was played out on. And so you'd get pressures from Fiat, you'd get pressures from the media, and you know, you'd be going off to a race and you'd see all the senior management. They'd arrive at the airport with hands full of newspapers, you know, Gazzetto and Corriere della Sera, you know, all of that, and they're reading, what are they saying about us? You know, they have their mind more on the media than on the task at hand. And I say, just chuck all that shit in the bin and forget about it and get on with your job. And it was hard for that to happen. And I arrived there saying, you know, I'm coming from a team that does almost everything almost perfectly. And, you know, you want to win and you're not winning. It means you got to change what you're doing. It means you have to change your approach. And we need to do that. And they were unwilling to do that. They said, no, we don't want to change. You have to adapt to us. And I'm thinking, well, how's that supposed to work? It works at McLaren. It doesn't work here. And you want me to change from the McLaren mentality to the Ferrari mentality? How's that supposed to work? And I'd give them this plan, you know, like, we're doing pretty good now. You know, you've been quite competitive last year. It's a pretty quick car and all that, the good basis for going forward. One problem is that it's not very reliable, and so we need to be absolutely fanatical about the reliability. You know, if you got a quick car and they both break down in the race, what use is that? I mean, look what that does. If you're running 1-2, and both cars break, and your competition now is elevated from third and fourth to first and second, the points turnaround is about 30 points or something. One race can be a season killer. You know, you need to be absolutely reliable. And therefore, we started a program where every race, in those days, between almost every race, there'd be a test, 3 or 4 day long test. And we made sure that one driver, at least one driver every day, would do a race distance. And it was that sort of intensive program that started them on their way to ultimate reliability. But the whole thing, it's just too chaotic, and they were too worried about the press and the pressures of the press and the pressures of the fans. And so I'm saying to him, you know, we're pretty competitive now, and we need to continue to be pretty competitive, and we need to improve in every area. And, you know, maybe next year we'll win a few more races, and the year after that we might sort of be challenging for the championship. And in 3 or 4 years, we've got the possibility of winning a championship if we continue along this program. And you need the whole thing to gel, and the design team needs time to gel and work together and all pull in the same direction, all this sort of stuff, all McLaren-esque sort of stuff. And they just say, no, we want to win the first race and we want to win the championship this year. Totally unrealistic, but that was their attitude. And when that didn't happen, they stir the human resources. You're out, these guys are in, you know. It just never had a chance to gel as a team. And so then, after a couple of years of the chaos, they finally get the sort of thing I was talking to you about previously. Jean Todt comes in, puts up a firewall, effectively. I'm going to take all the flack. Don't you guys, you know, Ross Brawn and all his team and all that, I'll take all the flack. I'll deal with the press. You guys, just don't worry about it. Get on with your job. And they did pretty much exactly what I said needed to be done. They established this fantastic group of people, you know, the drivers like Schumacher, for example, and Ross Brawn and some of his boys from Benetton. And they had Jean Todt protecting him, and they just carried on with the job. And it still took them maybe 4 years for Schumacher to win a world championship, which is exactly what I've been telling them. But it took Jean Todt to come along and say, this is what we're going to do. And we're going to carry on with this program. And at least they stayed hands off, so to speak, and let that team get on with it. And they had huge success, and they had almost perfect reliability. And it was a fantastic period. And then gradually, some of those people disappeared, and the chaos crept in, which is the sort of situation you've got now.
Yeah.
The chaos seems to be taking over, and the mistakes enter in, and you get what you've got.
Yeah, Ferrari is now contemplating its longest spell without winning a championship ever.
Which is incredible, and they've been in that situation before.
Yes.
You know, these huge fallow periods. You know, it's just sad, and I don't know what the answer is, really. Do you need to get more foreigners in and put them in a position of power where they can calm the chaos?
So after your spell at Ferrari, which sounds interesting to say the least, you
you were with Sauber and Jordan and Jaguar.
Yeah.
And later on, back at McLaren as a, in a sort of consultant role and involved in those fantastic Mika Häkkinen years in the late 90s, championship-winning years.
Yeah.
Goodness me, you've worked with some wonderful drivers over the years. So just to close out the episode, I just want to talk about some of the drivers you worked with. Starting with Niki Lauda.
Well, yeah, I've been very fortunate, really, to work for a major team like McLaren, major budget, fantastic driver, the whole organization. So Lauda, he was pretty incredible. And of course, we had that year in 1984 where he won his last world championship by half a point. Very intense, another very intense sort of season. And he was great to work with, really. When I heard he's first come to McLaren, I thought, oh my God, he's gonna give us such a hard time. You know, he's such a legend, and he's gonna want everything perfect. But he was a pussycat, really, and I think that was because we were a major team with major resources, and we were able to give him everything he wanted. I guess the most dominant characteristic I thought was his iron-willed determination. You know, you take the big accident and come back in 5 weeks or whatever it was and still not fully healed and do the job that he did there. And coming back at Monza where the conditions on the day were this miserly sort of rain, which was exactly the sort of circumstance he was in when he had his huge accident. And to come back from that, the determination was just incredible. And I remember once testing he asked me to go down to the Green Man with him and buy him lunch, Silverstone. And he told me about that experience, about the Nürburgring accident and about Monza. And hearing it like that, straight from the horse's mouth, you know, just thought, it's just incredible. And then fast forward to Prost and Lauda and that season, 84, we got to the French Grand Prix, and he's, I can't remember exactly, sort of halfway through the season, and he's 17 points behind Prost. And he said to me, Dijon, drive out to the circuit with me, and he's talking to me on the way out to the circuit, and he's saying, this little Frenchman, he is so quick, and it's hard for me. I can't benefit from his quickness. He can benefit from my experience and the setup we do and all that, and it is so hard to beat him. And I'm 17 points behind, and the season's half over, and, you know, it's really worse than even in the beginning when you had the whole season ahead of you and you were on an even number of points. And I've been trying my hardest, absolutely trying my hardest, but I'm not going to give up. And I'm going to win this race. And I'm going to win this championship. And I thought, Jesus, that's pretty strong, you know, to set yourself that goal from the position that you're in. But he did win that race. Prost had a little problem with a loose wheel nut or something, and so it was a bit fortuitous, but he won that race. And he won that championship by a half a point. And it's just mostly through iron will determination. Having said that, he was a fantastic driver. And he was at least as good as Prost, and he was at least as good as Senna. And their peaks came at different times. So Prost was on the uphill side, and he was on the downhill side, but he still managed to win that championship. And then you get Prost versus Senna, and it's a little bit now Prost's on the downhill side and Senna's on the uphill part of his career, and then, you know, you finally get the peak with Senna winning his championship. But I worked with all three of those guys, and I'd say they were equal, different characteristics, but the overall result is that they were equal, and their peaks occurred at slightly different times. So yeah, Lauda, great driver, all the characteristics you need, bravery, setup, determination, willing to lay it right on the line and risk everything when required, you know, just a just a fantastic, otherworldly sort of driver.
And apart from the physical scars from that horrible crash in 76 at the Nürburgring, were you ever aware of him having had that big accident? Did it affect him in any way that you could determine?
It didn't, to me, seem to affect him. He obviously had the scars, which he didn't really care about. Mm. You know, that was fine. He could still drive a car. He was still good at driving a car. It may have had some psychological impact. You know, it may have caused him to be a little more cautious about things, be more respectful of what he was doing. The speed of the cars, the safety aspect, what happens if you come off the road at the wrong place, that sort of thing. But he was still extremely good, you know, good at setting up the car and racecraft, you know, nursing the tires when you needed to, nursing the car when you needed to, you know, doing whatever you needed to do to get the thing home in the best possible position. He's just extremely good at all of that.
And Prost and Senna then, briefly. I mean, we often hear that Prost is called the professor. We often hear that Senna is the virtuoso talent. But it seems to me that they actually overlapped much more than that. That Prost had that preternatural speed and skill. That Senna had that profound understanding of the technical aspect of the sport. Is that
fair? I think that's all correct. And just talking about Prost, a lot of people think of him as somehow a bit inferior to Senna, and you know, he was more calm and didn't really wring its neck like Senna, perhaps. But the truth of the matter is that he was an incredibly good race car driver. He was also just an absolute normal guy to work with, you know, no sort of diva syndrome or superstar syndrome or anything. He's just a normal, average, everyday guy. Except for one thing, he was freakishly good at driving a race car. And he was so incredibly smooth that it didn't particularly look exciting, you know, but he was unbelievably talented and unbelievably good at driving a race car. The classic example I can think of is one year at Spa. Lauda had damaged his wrist and couldn't participate in qualifying, and so I was at a bit of a loose end, and I wandered off down to Eau Rouge, and you know, you could go over and stand next to the marshals, and it wasn't an official spectator area, so there weren't any loudspeakers. And you know, you see, for example, Mansell came out to do his lap, and it just looks phenomenal, you know. His hands are a blur, and just a shower of sparks, and the car looks electric, and you know, you just, oh wow, sort of thing, you know. And then Prost comes out to do his lap, and he goes through Eau Rouge, you know, his out lap, and it looks absolutely calm. And he comes through again, and it looks slow and absolutely calm. So I think, well, maybe there's a little problem. And he comes through a third time and looks absolutely calm. I thought, well, you know, he must have had a problem, because you can't hear anything on the loudspeaker. So walk back up to the garage, and he's on pole. And you couldn't tell the difference between the out lap, the fast lap, and the in lap. It's just that level of calmness, you know. And that is just fantastic. I know the Mansell thing is spectacular, and I know I was Rosberg's race engineer as well, Keke, this is, and he was just an ace bloke. I love the guy, but he was spectacular. He wasn't calm and smooth, he was just spectacular. But Prost, you know, he could put you to sleep. He was so smooth and yet devastatingly fast.
Wow.
Just incredible, really.
Goodness me. And Senna, I've heard you describing him before, working through a setup sheet. And he would want to work through every single parameter for every single corner, and really scrutinise each one to think about how each setup adjustment might affect him. And it would take hours to do this. So it's not as though you would bolt a Senna in and fast the car went. He put in an awful lot of work.
He worked at it. Yeah. You know, every second of his life was dedicated to winning races and winning a world championship. every second in the car, obviously, but every second he was at the track. And I remember once in a hotel, you know, we came down to have dinner, and he was sitting there alone having dinner with a pile of papers, you know, and analyzing all the data and what can I do to be better. And then, as you describe, the debriefs could last for a couple of hours, and he'd want to look at every parameter. And what will that do if we change it in every corner? And what will it do to the turn-in, to the mid-corner, to the exit? You know, and he would analyze every single bit of that over a period of a couple of hours. And sometimes you'd change quite a few things. And other times you might not change anything. But he would still want to analyze all of it and make sure that he was happy with all of it, even if he didn't change anything. So his dedication to the cause was just incredible. And I could imagine, I mean, that was in the car, at the track, away from the track. And I could imagine that he must have slept for 8 hours dreaming about how he could be better. So it was quite amazing. You know, great guy to work with. I know he was incredibly hard on his competition. And sometimes he'd even crash into him, like Prost in a Ferrari at Suzuka.
Yeah.
But, you know, we had a good working relationship, and he knew that I was helping him to get what he wanted, and so he was always really good to me. And he always wanted to share it with you. You know, the radios weren't that good in those days, but when he'd win a race or do a qualifying lap, I knew what was coming. He'd push the button, and it'd just be euphoric, and it'd be part English, part Portuguese, mostly unintelligible. Just the pure joy. He didn't want to... He wanted to push the button and share it with you, you know. I remember sometimes he'd get out of the car. I'd be on one side and he'd be stood on the other, and he'd put out his hand to shake my hand, and he'd be shaking like a leaf. And I'd grab his hand in both of mine to steady his hand and just look at us, it's all right. You know, doing what you just did, you deserve to shake a little bit. The level of intensity was incredible. There was one, I mean, another couple of little stories. I remember one time, about 5 minutes to go in qualifying, he's not on pole and obviously he wants to be. And he says, I got a little too much oversteer. And I want to change the springs. And I said, take 15 minutes, we can't do it. And he just sort of looks at me like, you know, you're the engineer, fix it. So I stuck a 3mm Packer under the bump rubber in the front suspension, and he went out and tried that, and it was better, and he put it on pole. You know, it was sort of that sort of working relationship, you know. Another time, to show you the intensity, late in qualifying, you only got a few minutes left, and I'm saying, all right, we got to go. And he still just sits there. So I give him a little bit of time, and I say, look, Ayrton, we've really got to go. So he gives the signal, start the engine, and he sits there a little while longer, and I'm saying, we've got to go. And then he pulls halfway out of the garage and stops again. And I say, Ayrton, this is it. You have got to go. You know, otherwise he wasn't going to make it around for the checkered flag. He couldn't start his lap. And so he went, and he put it on pole. And I said to him afterwards, what the hell was that all about? And he said, I was just trying to get my heart under control because it was pounding so fast and so hard. That's the level of intensity. Oh. When you're Ayrton Senna, that's the level of intensity. That is what he's putting in to those laps and those races.
Oh, blimey. Goodness me. What a privilege to have worked with all those guys.
And actually, well, at the time, it's sort of just a job, and it's so intense, and there's so much pressure. You're just trying to get on with the job and just trying to do it perfectly. I suppose it's only now. I talk to somebody like you, and you say, oh, wow. And I think, yeah, well, I guess it was sort of pretty special times. And a privilege and an honor for me. I'm very fortunate to been able to participate in that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, also, it's a privilege for me to get to talk to you and hear those stories, and I hope everyone listening enjoyed.
Well, that's very kind.
Hearing your memories about Formula One. And thank you also for talking about the Nichols N1A, your new road car that's coming very
soon.
Well,
yeah, I think it's a totally different thing, and it's quite exciting, really.
Yeah,
and like I say, it's got a connection to the past and kind of an old world sort of car in a modern world. And I think people, you know, the real enthusiasts will enjoy that sort of thing. Mm. So,
well,
we shall see.
Thank you, Steve, so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And to everyone listening,
thank
you for tuning in, and make sure you come back again next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.